The Ramban explains why the parashios we're going to be reading in the next few weeks are part of the book of Shmos. Shmos is the book of redemption. So redemption is spoken about in Shmos, Va'era, Bo. It speaks about the bondage in Egypt and the exodus from Egypt. Bishalach speaks about the splitting of the Red Sea, which culminated their freedom, physical freedom. Yisro speaks about the giving of the Torah, which connected their spiritual freedom with the physical freedom, because Ein Lecha Ben Chorin Ela Misha Osek BaTorah. Real freedom is only when a person is immersed in Torah. And that's why Shavuos is connected to Pesach. We count the days between Pesach and Shavuos, because Exodus from Egypt and the giving of the Torah have to go together. And that's why the fourth of the four expressions of Geula is V'lakachti Eschem Li La'am. I'll take you as my nation, which means the giving of the Torah. So that's fine. That's where the book of redemption should have ended. I can understand also why Mishpatim is important, because they also were given at Sinai to let me know that it's not only religious law, but civil law is also part of the Torah and part of God's revelation. But that's where Sefer Shmos should have ended. All the next parashios deal with the building of the Mishkan. That seemingly should have been in the next book, the book of Toras Kohanim, Vayikra, which deals with the laws of the sacrifices and the Kohanim and the Mishkan. So the building of the Mishkan should have been in the beginning of the book of Vayikra. What's it doing as the end of the book of redemption? Says the Ramban, because the redemption was not complete until God's presence devolved in the Mishkan and they returned to their original level that they had at the time of the Avos. Our Avos had God's presence on their tents constantly. They were totally connected to God on an ongoing basis. And they didn't return to that lofty level until God's presence rested on the Mishkan and really rested in the heart of every Jew. And that's when they were really redeemed. That's when redemption means not only that you're redeemed from negative, you're not under somebody else's rule, but it means that you're totally subjugated to God and that you have that total ongoing close relationship with God. That's when the redemption was completed. And that is the continuation of the giving of the Torah. God rested his presence on Har Sinai in order to give the Torah. And through the Torah, God bonds with us. The Torah is God's bond with the Jewish people. And the continuation of the giving of the Torah, of God's presence going along with the Torah, is in the Mishkan. That's where the Torah was continued to be given, and that's where God's presence rested, just like it rested on the top of Har Sinai. So the Mishkan was the continuation of the giving of the Torah, and the ongoing continuation of the giving of the Torah is in essence Geula. That is the quintessence of redemption. Okay. And that's why it says that when the Jewish people said Na'aseh V'Nishma, basically they accepted the Torah and they gave the green light for the giving of the Torah, that's when God said V'Yikhu Li Truma. There's a connection, obviously, because now they're fit to have the Torah given to them. So it's not a one time thing, it's an ongoing giving of the Torah, and God comes along with it. That's why it says V'Yikhu Li, take me together with the Torah. God gave us the Torah. The Medrash compares it to a father who married off his daughter. And he said, I can't part with her. So make me a little room where I can live together with you, where I can go together with my daughter. The Torah being the daughter, and the father being God, and the little room being the Mishkan. So God goes along with the Torah. Take me together with the Torah. And the Torah, like we said, the Torah is the bond that bonds us with God, and the Mishkan is the place, the medium for that bond to take place. However, it is not the building of the Mishkan itself that causes God's presence to come into this world. But rather, it's the desire to be able to link the physical and spiritual worlds, and to carry that out, that linkage of the physical and spiritual worlds, and the love of God, and the desire for that connection that actually brings the connection about. The Mishkan is only a means, but it's not the goal itself. It's not the cause itself. And I'll prove it to you. The proof is that if I were to tell you, I would come here and in one of two ways present a project. Okay, we need money. Why? Because we want to do this project. Or, I'd like to do this project, therefore we need money. Which way is the more normal way of presenting these two things? The need for money and the project that the money is going to go for. First, introduce the project, and then we need the money, which is the means to reach that project. Or, hey, we need money. Why? Well, because we want to have a project. Again, obviously the first way makes more sense. So why did the Torah say the second way? This week's Sedra starts. God tells Moshe to tell the Jewish people, V'yikli Truma, take an offering from them. And here are the materials we need. Why? Because we want to build a Mishkan. Wouldn't it have been more proper for God to say, we'd like to build a Mishkan, therefore we need materials? So why the opposite order? The answer is that it's the Me'es Kol Ish Ashid Venu Libo. It was the outpouring of people's hearts wanting to donate to the Mishkan, which created the wherewithal that there could be a Mishkan. It wasn't that the Mishkan was the goal and this was the means to reach it. This was the actual foundation of the Mishkan, wanting to give of yourself in order that God's presence should come into the world. The giving itself, the desire to give one's physical wherewithal for a spiritual purpose was the foundation of the Mishkan. The Vilna Gaon says that the pasuk means the following: the yikhuli truma, they should take for me truma, me'es kol ish ashid venu libo, from all the people whose hearts what's the word, good word for it? Yidvenu libo. Their hearts, what does he say here? Motivating. Whose hearts motivated them. Nidava means to have a tremendous desire to do something good. That their hearts, they donated their hearts, basically. Right? Nidava is a donation. It's something that a person gives of himself. Then tikhu es trumasi. Why did I have to say it again? Take my truma. It said, take my truma. So the Vilna Gaon learns that tikhu es trumasi is a quote, and it means me'es kol ish ashid venu libo, from every person whose heart moved him, tikhu es trumasi, and said, take my truma, take my offering, begged you, please take my offering. That's what I want. I want you to take it. And that's why there were two stages in giving the offering. They didn't just come along and take the materials, because that would imply that the giving of the materials was the main thing over here. First, the people separated their money, put it on the side, and designated it to be used towards the Mishkan, to be used towards something spiritual, towards God's will. And then they came and collected it. But the first thing was separated. That's the main thing. The main thing is not the collection, because God doesn't need your gold, silver. He can create his own. Doesn't need to take it from you. The main thing is that you should give it, not that it should be taken. So it's two separate things. By Truma and Meiser, it's the same thing. There's two ideas. There's the giving it to the Kohen, That has its purpose. The Kohen should get it. But there's an idea, even if you don't give it to the Kohen, to separate. The actual separation of taking something from what you could have for yourself and give it towards use for God, that in itself is something positive. That in itself is an issue to itself. And that is the whole purpose of Torah. What does Torah do? Torah elevates, sublimates every physical thing in this world and teaches you how to use it in fulfillment of God's will. That the physical things don't become only things that you can use for your own mundane physical purposes, but that you can elevate them, sublimate them, and use them in service of God, use them for higher spiritual purposes. That's what connects this physical world with the spiritual world, and Mamela enables God to bond with us in this physical world, which is what the Mishkan is. That's why it says, the Yikhu li Truma. Take the Truma li. Rashi says, for my name's sake, not for my sake. I don't need your Truma. You're not giving it to me so I can build a Mishkan. That's absurd. You're giving it to me because you want to give of yourself to something spiritual. That's, do it for the sake, for the, God's name, not for his sake, for his name. Meaning you want to dedicate these things, physical things, for a spiritual purpose. And that desire to give without any hope of reward, of getting anything back, right, is called lekicha, it's called taking. That kind of giving is in fact taking. You don't have any reason to get anything back physical, but you're getting back tremendous, tremendous benefit, right? The yikhu li truma. Because you're giving it to such a high purpose, from that you gain tremendously. You are elevated. And you become godlike, because you're giving totally, a total giving. That's what God does. God is a total giver. You become a total giver. In that respect, the giving itself enables you to give. The desire to give enables you to give. There's a medrash that says, Moshe Rabbeinu said, can the Jewish people afford this Mishkan? Can they do it? And God said, even one of them can do it. Because if they have the right desire, then I'll give them the wherewithal. The wherewithal doesn't come from them. It comes from me. All I want to see is they have a desire. If they have the desire, I'll give them whatever they need. So if one person with the right desire can get everything to give. Because anyway, it's not theirs. It's my doing. God says, I need their gold and silver. I gave it to them. But I want them to give it back, right? I want them to give it altruistically, and in that respect, they deserve everything to give. So the ability to give comes from the desire to give. The more desire you have to give, the more ability you have to give. That the Shalom HaKadosh says. And in that way, a person becomes like God, God-like, and that's how God bonds with us. So it's not the actual erection of the Mishkan that creates the place where God's presence can devolve. It's the tremendous desire to give and to create that Mishkan that creates that bond. So therefore, it doesn't say, we have to build a Mishkan, therefore give. No. Give, because that's the way that the Mishkan will be erected. It's not going to be erected unless you have that tremendous desire to give of yourself. And therefore, it's also taking, because you reach a tremendous level where you realize that you're really not giving anything. Everything belongs to God. You're giving Him what He gave you, of what He gave you. And only when a person recognizes that is he able really to give with a full heart. Because otherwise he feels he's giving up something that's his, and it's hard to do that. But it's easy to do it when you know you're not giving up anything that's yours. You're bonding with the Ribbono Shel Olam. You're becoming a total giver of what God gave you. And that's why the Parsha of the Mishkan, Seder Truma, comes after Seder Mishpatim. Because Mishpatim tells me what the Torah says is yours. What's legally yours. First you have to know Mishpatim to know what's yours and what's somebody else's. Because if you give somebody else's thing, all of this doesn't apply. It's only when you give what you understand God gave you. How does God give you anything? By telling you legally what's yours. what is yours, what's somebody else's. You have a dispute, money dispute, right? Somebody damages somebody. They owe the other person money. That money becomes theirs, not yours. So only after it's established in Parshas Mishpatim, what money is legally yours and who made it yours? God made it yours. Right, it's the Torah that says that money is your money and not somebody else's. You have rights to that money. So then you can take from what the Torah says is yours and give it up, knowing that it's yours because the Torah said it's yours. That means that God gave it to you. Now you're giving it and using it to fulfill His will. He gave it to you as a means to be able to fulfill His will. So you're using it for that purpose. And therefore the Chasam Sofer says the major donation is not the money, because that's not yours anyway. Right? It's not, God gave you that. What's the major donation is your heart, is your desire to give. That's the major donation. The Malbim says from the rich man we take his money, because if he doesn't give the money, then how do we know he has the desire? But a poor man has no money, so what does he give? He gives the desire alone. Take that from him. See that if he would have money, he'd have the desire to give it. Take the desire from him. And therefore it's called taking the yikhuli truma, right? Not the yitnu, not giving. They're taking because in giving that money and having the desire to give, it elevates them and it gives power, it gives that ability for God to bond with us. It gives us the ability to bond with Him and the male of Him to bond with us, because God waits for us. He's like a shadow, God. Whatever we do, He shadows us. And therefore, what's it called? The Mishkan, the bonding of God with us, only comes after we bond with God. How do you bond with God? By taking all your material being and having that desire to use it totally in fulfillment of God's will. And that's why the Mishkan was also a kapara. It was an atonement for the sin of the golden calf. The major sin of the golden calf wasn't the action. It was the thought. When it comes to idolatry, the main part of the sin is the thought of accepting some other power that separates between you and God. That's what Avodah Zarah is. Instead of being totally connected to God, you have some other power that comes between you. You separate yourself between God and yourself with some kind of physical power, some kind of power, ungodly power. That's idolatry. So the main sin of the golden calf was their desire to have some kind of intermediary between them and God, to separate between them and God. So what was the major atonement of the sin of the golden calf? Their desire to have that close connection with God and not to have anything separate. And all the physical things in the world to be used as a bond with God, not to be something that comes between you and God. So that was a kapara, that was an atonement for the sin of the golden calf.
What?
And that's which I hold the questions until the end, write them down and over. And that's why the order of the parashios is first the giving of the Torah, which was the totally spiritual occurrence, and then the Seder Mishpatim, which deals with the physical world. Now bond the two together. Take that spiritual occurrence, make the physical world represent that by wanting to use every physical thing for the sake of that spiritual, what's the word I'm looking for? Revelation, that spiritual experience that you had. And then you have a Mishkan. Then you can build a Mishkan. That's exactly what the Mishkan is. Now I want to relate all of this to a leap year. In Hebrew it's not called a leap year. It's called a Shana Mu'beres, a pregnant year. Why is the year pregnant? So simply because it has an extra month inside of it, right? But there's much more to it. The idea of a leap year is to create this harmony between the physical world and the spiritual world. In order to bond to God, you have to not let the physical world come between you, but just the opposite. You have to use the physical world as a bond to God. Then it's not something that separates, just the opposite, it's something that connects. So there always has to be a balance or a harmony between the physical and the spiritual. That's what a leap year accomplishes. Because there's a solar year that goes by the sun, right? 365 and a quarter days, approximately. And then there's a lunar year that goes by the moon. Okay? Now the lunar year is a shorter year, right? 12 lunar months is only 354 days. And 12 solar months is 365 days. So in order to harmonize a lunar year and a solar year, approximately every 3 years you have an extra month. So you have to add that extra month to make sure that the seasons don't travel through the lunar year. In other words, if Pesach, when we went out of Egypt, there was tremendous harmony between the spiritual idea of Pesach and the physical idea of the year. It was the time of spring. Spring is renewal. The Jewish people were being renewed at that time. So the spiritual renewal and the physical renewal came together. Okay? There has to be that harmony maintained all the time. Because if this year Pesach would be in the spring, next year it would be 11 days earlier if you only went by the lunar year. So it would be 11 days early in the spring. The next year would be already 22 days. By the next year it would be a month earlier, it would be in the winter, the end of the winter. In 3 more years it would be in the middle of the winter. That's how the Arab, the Muslim calendar goes. Their Ramadan, right, is only purely based on the moon. And therefore it fluctuates every 3 years. It's a month earlier according to the solar year. So it could be in the summer, the winter. There's no consistency when it comes to the seasons, when it comes to their celebrating their holy days. But us, the Torah said no. Make sure that Pesach always comes in the spring. In order to do that, you have to somehow compensate for those 11 days that are different between the lunar year and the solar year. That's by adding a month approximately every 3 years. So that's the harmony between the sun, which represents the physical world, and the moon that represents the spiritual world. The moon is smaller, it's hidden, it fluctuates, it's not constant like the physical world we see. And therefore the physical spring renewal and the spiritual renewal of the Jewish people that reoccurs every year, that we relive every year, always coincide. And the leap year does that, the pregnant year. And that's why pregnant. The child is more spiritual. Because the child, before he's born, has come from a spiritual world, hasn't yet come out into this physical world. It says it's a candle lit by his head. Not literally, it means there's a spiritual presence by this little baby, by this embryo. He can see from one end of the world to the other as an embryo. We forget all of that. He's learning Torah, right, in the womb. Every embryo, men, women, learn Torah in the womb. All the Torah that they're ever going to be able to learn, they learn already there. Very spiritual thing, right? Some say that that's why women have heartburn when they're pregnant, because of the candle that's burning. I mean, but that's not what it means. And so the baby represents that hidden, small, in this world, spiritual entity, and the mother is the big external physical entity. The physical gives a plant for the spiritual to be able to exist, but the spiritual gives a continuity to the physical. So they go together. That's why the year is a pregnant year. Because it's the kind of year that meshes the physical, the solar year, with the spiritual, the lunar year, and makes them harmonize together. That's why it's called a pregnant year. And that's why the month that makes this harmony is an extra Adar. The zodiac symbol of Adar is fish. Fish have these two qualities too. On the one hand, they're hidden from sight. They're a more spiritual thing hidden, like the embryo is hidden. Yet fish have a tremendous, their prolific nature, right? You multiply like fish. So on the one hand, there's this tremendous ribui, which is a symbol of nature, of physicality, right? Quantity. At the same time, they're hidden from view, which is more of a spiritual concept. That's why the month of Adar also has both ideas. The Maral points out that in a circle, Adar is both the closest month to Nisan and the farthest month. It's the closest month to the spiritual renewal of the Jewish people, and it's the farthest month. So it has a physical concept to it, being the farthest from the beginning of a spiritual, and yet it's the closest to the spiritual too.
Why is the farthest?
Well, because if you start from Nisan, the last month of the year is Adar. On the other hand, looking ahead, the next month is Nisan. So in a circle, the farthest point from the beginning point is also the closest point to the beginning point. And that's why Moshe Rabbeinu was born in the month of Adar, and he died in the month of Adar. The born is being born into this physical world, and death is leaving this physical world and becoming more spiritual. So you have both like concepts. The concept of gaining physicality and losing physicality. All makes one circle. They're not separate things. The physical and spiritual world have to mesh and harmonize. They're all really the same. And that's why there's another Purim. There's a Purim Katan and a Purim Gadol. Purim itself represents God's presence in the physical world. So here we have an extra Purim to prepare for that big Purim, the Purim that makes the, what's it called, the big Purim coincide the physical with the spiritual. That's why in this kind of year there's an extra kapara. When we daven Musaf on Rosh Chodesh, so in a regular year we say that this is a year of Slicha and Mechila, right? It's a year of forgiveness. The what's it called? Rosh Chodesh is a time of forgiveness. But in a leap year we add Kaparas Pesha. Not only is there forgiveness like Slicha and Mechila, pardoning and forgiving, there's also Kaparas Pesha. There's the atonement for Pesha. Pesha has two meanings. Pesha sometimes means negligence. Somebody sins because he's not careful. He's negligent. Okay, that's one kind of sin that this leap year helps to atone for. And then Pesha can also mean merit. Merit means rebellion, where a person, mamish, doesn't sin because his Yetzer Hara pushes him to it. He doesn't sin because he made a mistake. He sins consciously, not because he's drawn towards it, because he wants to rebel, just for the sake of rebellion. Right? He has a beautiful, delicious kosher steak there, ready to eat, and some really disgusting non-kosher meat, and he'll eat the non-kosher meat rather than the kosher steak. Right? Once in Miami, what's it called? I wasn't married yet, and there was a supermarket. Then there was one kosher supermarket in Miami. Now there's like who knows how many. Now the non-kosher supermarkets are kosher. So the an old Jewish man, he couldn't have, he was probably from Europe. I mean, originally, right? Spoke with a heavy accent. Walked into this kosher supermarket on Chol HaMoed Pesach, and he wanted chametz tikka matzah. He wanted matzah, but not the kosher Pesach matzah. He wanted matzah that was chametz, the regular yearly matzah. What the difference between them? Right, one tastes different than the other. Right, just that they're not careful to make sure it's made within 18 minutes. But he wouldn't eat the Pesach tikka matzah. He only wanted, that's merit, that's rebellion. Right? It's not his Yetzer Hara said, I have to have that matzah that's, you know, tastes so much different and so much. You don't want bread, you want a matzah, but matzah that's not for Pesach. Right? That's rebellion. Maybe, I don't know. Not in America, it doesn't make that much of a difference. Not by Chol HaMoed, the prices went down. Maybe, let's be done with the kafschus. I never thought of that. You good. Right. I'm sure he's no longer here in this world, and good, done with kafschus. He wanted it because it was cheaper, not because he wanted to. Very good. I don't know why I didn't think of that. In any case, but that's called rebellion. What's the two things have in common? What they have in common is the following. What's it called? Negligence comes because there's no harmony between your physical side and your spiritual side. Your spiritual side wants to do something, but your body doesn't click in and go together with it. So the leap year, the pregnant year, the Shana Muberes, right, compensates and harmonizes the physical and the spiritual. So sins that are caused because of a lack of harmony, a lack of synchronization between the physical and the spiritual, which results in negligence, are atoned by that year. That's one idea. There's another idea, though. The idea of the total antithesis of what the leap year represents. The pregnant year represents the total synchronization and harmony of the physical and the spiritual for the good. To use them both to serve God. And mered, rebellion, is the total synchronization and harmony of the physical and spiritual to rebel against God. Other sins, there's no synchronization. Either it comes because your body overpowers your neshama, right? You really don't want to do it, like, intellectually, but you just can't control yourself emotionally, right, sensually. Or you, intellectually want to go do something that's wrong, and your body, you have to pull your body along with it, right? But when you rebel, both your body and your mind are in sync, but they're in sync against the Ribbono Shel Olam. So the year that has the opposite effect, it synchronizes the physical and the spiritual in service of God, that has the power to atone for both negligent kinds of sins, which results from the non-synchronization of your body and soul, and sins of rebellion, which unite your body and soul, but only in the negative way. And here, the positive thing has a ability to atone for that. And that is why Mishenichnas Adar Marbin B'Simcha Adar, which happens to be the month that always sees to it that this synchronization, this harmony, it happens, sometimes by adding an extra Adar, and sometimes that's not necessary, right? The Simcha, what's happiness? When you're in harmony, when there's no conflict between your physical and spiritual sides, when both of them unite in service of God, then there's real happiness. So Mishenichnas Adar Marvin B'Simcha, that Adar which has the power of creating that harmony between the physical and spiritual worlds, between the solar year and the lunar year, the physical and the spiritual, that's the ultimate to Simcha. So therefore Adar brings Simcha. That's the idea. And it's not only Adar, and it's not only extra Adar, but it's Nisan too. The connection between Adar, which is more the physical, and Nisan, which is more the spiritual, right, and seeing to it that they both are synchronized, the physical month of Adar with the spiritual, and the physical month of Nisan with the spiritual, right, then Nisan and Adar are times of Simcha, because both of them become times of harmony. You harmonize the spiritual with the physical in Adar, and you harmonize the physical with the spiritual in Nisan. Make sure that both of them always are working together. Okay, we have time for one more thing, small thing. Any questions on this? That clock is very slow, but my watch is a little fast, so it's somewhere between the two. I have time for one idea. Yeah.
You said that when I understood that the sin of the Haifa ego. The Mishkan is like to atone.
Right, it has an aspect of atonement. There would have been a Mishkan even without the Chet HaEgel. But after the Chet HaEgel, the Mishkan took on another aspect of atonement for the sin of the golden calf. The idea being, the golden calf was a physical thing that separated between God and the Jewish people.
No, what I read is that even though, okay, it was a sin because they created this figure,
right.
No? It was really not a sin because they were seeking to be close to
Right, but they wanted to be close to God through an intermediary, not directly. They wanted to go through something that was a go-between, and that separated them. But Sheinkein, the Mishkan took all those things of physical and totally devoted them to God. So the Mishkan was not an intermediary; it bonded you to God directly.
But then Moshe also with like
yeah, but that was a mistake. They thought that Moshe was an intermediary. He wasn't. Moshe was the giver of the Torah. The Torah bonds you to God. It's not something that separates you from God. Moshe's whole power was the power of Torah, not him as a human being who was intermediary. He was the giver of the Torah, and that's how he bonded you to God. The Torah bonds you to God. It doesn't. It's not an intermediary between you and God. Torah is God's will itself. So it's being connected to the Torah is not being connected to something, and then that something is connected to God. That something is God's will itself. That's the idea.
But what I mean is that the people saw Moshe.
Right. That was their mistake. That was exactly the mistake. Right, and that's what you needed a Mishkan to atone for. That the physical, not the physical person, the physical ego, should not be a separation, but the whole physical world should be something that bonds you directly to God, and that comes between you and God. That's the idea. Well, let me tell you, that's a called a quick thing to finish. It says that the Aron was gold on the inside, gold on the outside. It was a wooden box, laid with gold on the inside and laid with gold on the outside. We learn from that a Talmud Chacham should be gold on the inside, gold on the outside. His inside should be like his outside. So the Das Akenu Rebbele Atosa says, if that's the symbolism, wouldn't it have been better if the Aron was solid gold? Not wood covered with gold on the inside and outside, solid gold. He says, yeah, it probably would have been a much greater symbolism, but it would have been impossible to carry. It'd be much too heavy. It was solid gold. He says, and even though the Aron carried itself miraculously, that's a miracle. We don't rely on miracles. So it had to be able to be carried naturally too. That's what he says. Now let me tell you how I applied that. Sounds like a very practical, you know, question and answer. I once had a girl in my kehila, about 16 years old. And she was a balas tshuva. Her mother was a widow, and she was an only child. And she became frum through NCSY. And her mother knew nothing about Yiddishkeit, zero. But she was a very, very good mother. She herself didn't become religious, but she accommodated her daughter for everything. She koshered the house, and she didn't do anything on Shabbos that would offend her, and everything. She went and bought her a whole wardrobe of what sneezdika clothes, anything the girl wanted. But the mother, like every day, was something new that the girl learned about, she didn't know before, and all of a sudden she came to her mother, another thing, or whatever. So the mother used to come to me for guidance, you know. In any case, we had in that time, in our community, a butcher shop that brought meat in from Denver. Oh, you glut meat. The rabbis used it, the tzibur used it. But there were some people in the kehila that wanted chassidish shechita. It's nothing to do with the kashrus guidelines or hidurim. For instance, they would only accept shechita from a shochet that had a beard. He could be Moshe Rabbeinu, if he didn't have a beard. We don't use a shechita. It was not halacha, it was more of a hiddur. So they wanted that chassidish shechita. They were chassidim, and they wanted that hiddur. But to bring meat in like that cost double. They had to bring it in like every 3-4 months, and you had to order a whole 4 quarters and keep it in a separate freezer because it was too much meat to put in your regular freezer. So whoever wanted, and they had to go to like a central pickup place to get it because it wasn't, well, they couldn't have a butcher shop that existed on this meat. It was impossible. So you had to pick it up. You had to travel like 25 miles outside of Miami and back to pick up the meat. So one day this mother comes to me and she says, Rabbi, are you an Orthodox rabbi? I said, yeah. She said, I thought so. How come you don't eat kosher? I said, what do you mean? She said, well, my daughter said that the butcher shop that you buy your meat in and you supervise and the other rabbis buy their meat is not kosher, and we have to buy a freezer, travel 50 miles round trip, and buy this meat that costs double the amount because that's the only one that's kosher. I said, I'll take care of it. So I called the girl in. And I told her, I said, listen, if you were married and you had to make the trip to buy the meat and you had to buy the freezer, you had to pay the double price, then matovu manoyim. That's beautiful. You want to be solid gold. You want to do something extra. Mohoder is beautiful. But if in order to be solid gold, you're going to be too heavy to carry, somebody else has to carry you, then that's not proper. Your mother's the one who has to pay the money. Your mother has to buy the freezer. Your mother has to make the trip. Right? For you to make an extra hiddur, but on your mother's expense, that's not proper. If it would be halacha, right, kosher, not kosher, so fine. Your mother's schus that you should eat kosher. So even though it's on her cheshbon, you can't give in on that. But to be extra special, solid gold, better you shouldn't be solid gold. You want to get up at midnight and cry over the Beis HaMikdash, fine. But don't wake up the whole family. Right? Not on their cheshbon. You want to go outside and do it outside. Right? Don't do it in the living room where you're keeping up the whole family. They don't have to carry your hidurim so you could be solid gold. If it's too heavy to carry, then maybe you shouldn't be solid gold. Then maybe you should be a little wood on the inside. That's the lesson. Where that applies and where it doesn't apply, you need to ask a shaila every time. But the idea does apply sometimes, that sometimes it's kedai not to be solid gold if you're going to be too heavy to be carried by other people.